G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Mathis.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnus.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Smith from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you're indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a couple of topics under discussion, maybe more than two. We tend to get sidetracked a fair bit on this show lately. And we're also going to be hearing from a man who, the word's often overused, but I think he is truly a legend. And he's certainly a legend of Australian hockey, and that is former Kookaburras captain Mark Knowles. And that will be coming up later in the show. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee. And I'm really looking forward to hearing Mark Knowles.
Yeah, I mean, he is a legend, though, isn't he, John? In Australian sport, when you look at everything that he's achieved, to be a junior world player of the year, senior world player of the year, win an Olympic gold, win World Cups, win Commonwealth gold medals, to win competitions in, I think, three or four different leagues around the world. Certainly three, because he won in the Hoof class in the Netherlands. Yeah. He won the Hockey India League, and he's won the Australian Hockey League. So, pretty special player.
I think it's very hard to use a word like legend, but when you look at his achievements at an international level across all sports, he stands out like a beacon, doesn't he? And he's probably retiring as the best tackler in the game. I mean, if you're an attacker and you're running towards goal and you look up, oh, just one man to beat, oh, God, it's Mark Knowles, you know?
But I think the other thing that, to me, and it's one thing being a great player, but the respect that he holds off the pitch from everybody, to me, that is something that does lift you to that higher status. And if you talk to anyone around the world, he is highly regarded. I know there's a lot of people don't like the way he used to moan to the umpires, or he very cleverly, when there was a referral, he goes, can you look at that while you're looking at this within the microphone? So that obviously, but I mean, that was clever. To me, that's good leadership. I mean, Sean Fitzpatrick used to.
Gamesmanship.
Yeah. Sean Fitzpatrick for the All Blacks was a brilliant extra referee for them, wasn't he?
Well, you know? They've got New Zealand rugby's got a lot of extra referees running around. Hey,
look, George Gregan was pretty good at it as well.
He was. And it happens in cricket too. I mean, there was a lot of umpires that if Shane Warne appealed, oh yeah, well, Warne appealed, it must be out. Off you go.
I remember I used to play against a team once a year. Stopped after the third year because when this guy appealed, his dad, who was the umpire, always gave the wicket. And 3 years in a row, I got given out when I knew that I wasn't out. So I went, I'm not playing in the game next time.
Just quickly before we move on Mark Knowles, what seems to be universal is he's a straight-up guy. He's a really straight-up guy that's honest and has a great deal of integrity. And considering his record, his playing record and his achievements in his sport, remarkably egoless, especially compared to some Australian sports people who've achieved nothing and whinge and complain about it.
No, fair point. Now we touched on, John, I'm going to start us off today, we touched on cricket, and there's been an announcement that was made probably the end of April, and it was something when I heard it, I thought, oh, that's really stupid. But then the more I've thought about it, I actually think it's not a bad idea. Now, I'm not sure if you saw it, but the International Cricket Council announced at the end of April that all 104 of its member nations, both men and women, were going to be granted T20 international status. Now, I'm not a big fan of T20, I'll be honest, but there is probably a place for it in those developing nations, giving them exposure, playing against better nations and in awe of developing players, and it's probably not a bad way to do without sort of hampering the development of the game. It's giving them a chance to rise up, and the problem of cricket's always had is it's been a very much a closed shop at test level, and it's been very difficult for teams to break into that test level. And I remember we've discussed this before on the show. Ian Peebles, the cricket writer, years ago, he was suggesting that test teams, when they first came in, should play maybe 3 or 4 day test matches rather than a 5 day test, because they just didn't have the depth to last 5 days. Now, that was never obviously accepted, and there's a lot of people go, well, no, it's a test match, it must be 5 days, that's the way it should be. And I hear that, and I'm a traditionist, but I think this may be the option or a way that we're going to see, and I see it especially in the women's game, that you may see some nations that are not traditional cricket nations as we know them may actually now get a chance. They may develop through T20 and become a major force in the women's game.
Yeah, I think it's a good move. I mean, cricket has a tiered system, you know, you got your tier one nations, tier two, etc. And other sports have those tiered systems as well. It's not just cricket that does that. But in within the cricket system, to move between tiers is a very unsure path. I mean, in most sports that have the tiered system, there is a set down set of criteria. You know, win this tournament and you will be promoted to the next tier, and the team from that tier up is going to come down and play in tier two. But that, it doesn't work like that in cricket. There's no set formula for you to go up to the next grade. And it can be a very, as we've seen with Ireland recently, who've just played their first test, a very long and drawn out process to get there. And this just brings cricket in some ways in line with the rest of the world as far as sports go, and you need it. You need to be able to encourage nations that if they improve, that is the pathway. This is how you do it. So they can see a finish line. If there's no finish line for them, if all they're going to be doing is butting their head up against a wall continuously, then they very well soon lose interest.
Well, I mean, just to give you an example back at the point you're making, John, at present there are 18 members with T20 international status. So 12 full members, which are most of the test playing countries that play, plus Scotland, the Netherlands, Hong Kong, the UAE, Oman and Nepal, which Nepal would surprise me. I didn't appreciate that. But now, when you blow it from 18 to 104, it becomes almost like the FIFA World Cup. There are teams like Bhutan who know they're never going to qualify probably for a World Cup in the next 70 years, I would think. However, they get to be a part of that whole qualification process. They're part of the whole tournament at the very early stages. And it's the same if you look at it in England with the FA Cup. You know, there are all the non-league teams play. I know we've got that with the FFA Cup, but I still don't think the model of the FFA Cup here is quite right yet, in that it's not. Yeah. To me, it doesn't quite happen.
And no one knows it's on.
Yeah, it's still got a bit of a way to go, I think, before you have that, where until the draw is actually drawn out of a hat and you play at home grounds and against that, and there's no seeding and all of that.
There's no fairy tales of qualifying for a final series that you were drawn and seeded to qualify for anyway.
Yeah, but I think that, I mean, if you look at it again with this T20 international idea, is it's going to give those nations as well the opportunities to go out now and get sponsorship that they didn't have, because it is a qualified international game. And so then that's going to, with itself, lift the kudos of actually playing for your country, lift the profile of the sport. And I just think it, and if you think about certain areas where you could play each other fairly regularly and help each other all climb the ladder and develop as a team. And so an idea that when I read about it, I was like, I'm not sure about this one. But then the more I've thought about it, the more I think, for once, the ICC has actually got it right.
2020 is the ideal platform for it too, if you consider the skill sets involved. Now, for most nations that want to try and break into test cricket who aren't a traditional test playing nation, the skill sets are very, very tricky to try and master, especially the batting skill set. But once you get to T20 cricket, all you need is a bloke or lady with great hand-eye coordination, and they can change the whole game. They don't necessarily have to know how to do a forward defence in the classic position. They just have to know how to smash the ball as hard and as far as they can. And it will be, bowling will be the skill set that is the most difficult to transfer for those minnow nations. If they can get some bowlers happening, the batting side of it will look after itself.
Now, the other interesting thing that's linked to this, and I don't know if you saw that, because Champions Trophy, there's a Champions Trophy in hockey, which will come to an end this year. And there's a champ, yeah, I agree with you there, but there's also been the Champions Trophy in cricket.
Yep.
And that is supposedly also coming to an end, because it was announced by the CEO of the ICC, David Richardson, and I will quote him there: in all likelihood, the 2021 Champions Trophy will be a World T20, he said. Now, apparently, while the decision to convert the 2021 edition has met with some reservations from, yes, you guessed it, India, the decision now stands finalised. The move would mean that there will be two back-to-back World T20 events in 2020 in Australia and in 2021 in India. According to Richardson, the World T20 will continue to take place every 2 years after 2021, while the 60-over World Cup will take place every 4 years. So the Champions Trophy is going to go. And I find, again, with this. If you remember when T20 started, it was never going to be truly taken seriously. It was always a bit of a hit and a giggle, but now, man, is it changed from those initial thoughts.
You've changed your initial thoughts?
I haven't, no.
Okay. Well, you know, T20's what it is.
It's fast food sport.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, with a special sauce on top.
Yeah. And so, look, as I say, I've yet to watch a game, and it just doesn't appeal to me at all.
Look, I think it's it hasn't had the effect that perhaps some people thought. It hasn't been the game that some thought it was. I think now the key skill in 2020 cricket is bowling. It's not batting, because any idiot can stand there and tee off. It's the bowlers that now control T20 cricket, and if your bowlers aren't on, mate, they'll go. They'll get hit. I think that's not what we expected. We didn't expect spinners to be a big part of the game. We thought they'd all be slapped out of the field, but now it's turning out spinners are actually a key. If you've got a decent leg spinner in your side, you're halfway to winning. When was the last time we spoke about leg spinners being match winners in that way?
Well, Shane Warne came on the scene.
Yeah, there is him, and I'm sure that they saw Tiger Bill and blokes like that as match winners as well in the day.
But you know the interesting thing there, and I'm just going to slightly go off track here, because you said that, and I agree with you 100% that bowling has become that. I was really surprised to hear when I was talking to someone involved in development of the game, and they were saying that they were told to go out there, and this was the directive coming from the top of Cricket Australia, that when they're looking for talent, it's literally all about speed. That Darren Lehman said, if we can produce four fast bowlers that can bowl at X speed, then we will win test matches. This was obviously when he was the coach. He is now, of course, part of the high performance as well, because he's been given a job there. But
that's a whole other show.
It is indeed. Yeah, we could debate about that one for a while. But the thing that I found quite terrifying about that is, so they said literally when we're going trials, it's a speed gun and we choose the fastest guys and go, okay, we're going to work with you. Now, to me, that is madness because, you know, there are young bowlers that may not be as quick now because their bodies haven't matured, but they can move the ball, or they're consistently putting the ball on a spot, as opposed to a guy who can just rip it quickly and be as wild as anything.
Well, is there any surprise that fast bowlers keep breaking down recently? If all you're asking them to do is to bowl as fast as they possibly can, then that is going to be the natural outcome.
Yeah,
injury.
I mean, look, I was absolutely gobsmacked when I heard that. I thought it was one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. I mean, I remember we had a guy I played with. He was like lightning, but he had no idea where the ball was going to go, which it was terrifying as a batsman because you never knew if it was going to be round your ears, it was going to go for four wides, where it was going to go. I mean, if he got one on target, it would probably go through you, but he never played first team because he wasn't. Couldn't put the ball on the spot.
Let's trace back through the true speedsters of the game and the real high-end ones for a moment. Okay, recently, Sean Tate. Geez, he had to be really on, because if he wasn't really on, he was hit out of the ground. Shoaib Akhtar. Shoaib, on his day, fearsome. But he didn't have many days.
Agreed.
Brett Lee.
I think overrated, personally.
Well, when he bowled fast and put it on the spot, he beat blokes for pace. And I think that's where Lehman's probably thinking, is that if you bowl fast enough, it doesn't matter how good the batsman is.
But
humans can only cope with things at a certain...
See, Brett Lee, to me, though, if you look, how many times did he rip open the upper top order of a team? Very rarely. He tended to pick up two or three wickets at the end of an innings, he'd rip through the tail.
Yeah, he'd go through
to
the
me,
tail.
He didn't get enough top order wickets in his career. Whereas if you look at someone like Alan Donald, he tended to get wickets at the top order.
And I mean, you look at a bowler like Glenn McGrath, who was pretty medium pedestrian as far as pace goes. Yeah, he wasn't the quickest fast bowler
around. You see, that's my argument.
Yeah.
Glenn McGrath was a clever bowler. He could put a ball on the spot. He could tie them down. He could move it both ways. He was, to me, world-class
bowler. Well, even think of a guy
bowler
like Dennis Lilley, who, when he first burst onto the scene, was a tearaway quick. I mean, he was seriously fast, but he does his back. He comes back. And he becomes that bowler that bowls within himself, just slightly, still bowling quick, but that guile, being able to finding different ways to get blokes out without just using blistering pace.
Yeah.
You know, those really, 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 really quick blokes, and we've all seen it throughout club cricket and international cricket, state cricket, very often struggle to be long-term outstanding bowlers.
And consistent.
And consistent, that's a good word for it. I don't get the whole pace thing, personally. I mean, yeah. Most blokes hate facing spinners, certainly in this country. I don't know about in England and stuff, but for most batsmen, it's the spinners.
I hate slow left-armers.
Slow left-armers? Oh, I wish I had a bolt against you.
I'm glad you didn't.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacobi from Germany, playing for the Delhi Waveriders. You're hearing Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to the podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as we mentioned at the top of this podcast, we're very pleased to have as our guest on this show a man who just announced his retirement at the Commonwealth Games, having gone out with yet another gold medal to hang around his neck. We are, of course, talking about the Kookaburras captain, Mark Knowles. Mark Knowles, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hi, Ash.
I'm very well, thanks. Well, I suppose the first question is, how are you adapting to retirement?
Oh, very well. I'm enjoying it, actually. I doing a lot more with the family. The work part of working full-time is not as normal as, you know, what most people would think. But I'm getting into it. I'm finding my rhythm. And I'm doing some nice appearances and talks and, you know, school visits and stuff, which is also kind of keeping me on that high a little bit.
No, excellent. I mean, obviously we want to just talk to you and maybe look back on what has been a fantastic career, you know, over a fairly long period of time. And I just wanted to, first of all, did you always have aspirations to play for the Kookaburras?
Oh, I think from when I was relatively young, I don't think we fully understand what the national teams are when you're young, but my parents used to drive me the 8 hours from Rockhampton to Brisbane to watch the National League for the Queensland Blades. Kind of got my first real taste in 1994. We went to the World Cup in Sydney. I was 10, and I had a bit of that bug about me that I wanted to. My biggest turning point was the Sydney Olympics in 2000. I was 16 years old. I was, you know, one of the good players in the country and one of the good players in the state. But that was the point where I really thought to myself, wow, how amazing is this? And I want to do this.
Now, I mean, it wasn't really a dream start for you, was it? Because just as you were about to break through, you broke your ankle. And then when you came back, you broke it again. So, I mean, did you actually kind of think, this is never going to happen?
Yeah, it was. It was a very tough year in 2003. I'd moved from Rockhampton to Brisbane at the end of 2001. Lived in Brisbane for a year, just starting to find my feet, then got invited to Perth on an AOS scholarship. As you said, the first day I got pretty much named in the national squad, I broke my ankle. 16 weeks later, and after those 4 months of rehab, broke it again, my first ever training session with the Kookaburras guys. It was really, really difficult. But I think the part for me that I tried to do was I tried to show the guys that I just loved it. Yeah, I was injured and it was so hard and disappointing, but I actually tried to buy into the culture even though I couldn't train. And as I've been through this journey, there's so much more to it than just the stick and ball each day. And I think I gained quite a lot of respect from the guys out of, you know, the way that I went about it even when I was injured.
You mentioned there the culture, and we've read a great deal about obviously the All Blacks and that responsibility of putting on that shirt. And it seems that the Kookaburras, the success they've had over the last 30 years, that they've managed to sustain that same culture within the team. I mean, how is that done for an outsider to understand? I mean, when you come in, are you told these are the rules and this is how you'll behave? Or is it just something by watching everybody else you realise that these are the expectations on a Kookaburra?
Oh, I think a little bit of both. I think we also understand where we sit in the Australian landscape of sport. You know, we aren't the absolute premium brand in Australia. There's some other sports that are better or bigger. And there's a part of us that really has to buy into that because you want to be part of it. And it's not because the payday at the end. It's not because you're guaranteed success. But it's what has come before you. So I'd say that there is that part of seeing people before you do it and you wanting to do it yourself. I think the other part with culture is that it's constantly evolving and changing. You know, one culture, for example, before 2004, that culture doesn't remain the same forever. We've had to grow. We've gone up. We went down for a little bit. We've had to find new ways to make people tick and inspire them and be inspired ourselves. Sometimes we're not inspired and we have to find a spark ourselves. Sometimes we have to think about the why we do it and how we play the game and who we are. And other times we need to be told. So there is a large amount of work and effort that goes into culture, but it is always changing and moving. And that's probably the part where I've looked back now. I don't class myself as this highly knowledgeable retired player from a long time ago. I'm only just out of it, as you know, but you do get to reflect a little bit, and I've been able to reflect over the past, you know, even just a couple of months since I announced my retirement, that it does move, it does change, and when you sit still, you're going to get caught.
In that sort of thinking back, did you ever think in 15 years on from when you started, did you think the game by then might have turned professional? I mean, we've seen netball now. The netball girls are actually earning a decent living from playing the sport. Did you think that hockey would get to that stage in your career's time?
Oh, not really. I kind of came in at the start in 2004. There was a couple of pioneers before me who played over in Europe. You know, Troy Elder and Brent Livermore were really early on. Jamie Dwyer straight after Athens. That was when the European club scene was becoming more popular. I was extremely, extremely lucky to get a European contract at my age. But I played the Junior World Cup in Rotterdam in 2005. And a year later, they wanted a senior international player. We just won the Olympics. I was a junior World Cup player from Australia. We played in the World Cup final. So I thought that there was possibilities for our game to grow. Where they would go to and where they can get to, we don't know. We've seen over the last 5 or 6 years the power of India and what that's provided us as young men and young guys playing the sport. So there are some great opportunities. We're an Olympic sport, which not all sports are. We're able to now play in Europe, in Belgium, England, the Netherlands, Germany, just to name a few. And then you've got, you know, that extra added bonus with India now being a bit closer to us, a bit shorter. So there are opportunities. I think it's an amazing thing to do as a young person, is to be able to travel and experience different cultures and people and teams and coaches. And that really helped me on my journey as a player, but also just, you know, freshening up and doing different things constantly allows you to really enjoy those tough times when you're with the Cookers and you're doing sand dune running or pre-season work or hill sprints. You do think of those other times where you have to travel the world and someone wants you.
Now, you mentioned there the Olympics, and obviously you were very fortunate to be a member of the 2004 Olympic winning, gold medal winning side, and you've pretty much won everything there is in the game, the Champions Trophy, the World League, Aslan Shah, World Cup, and the Olympics. Why is it that the Olympics is still the big one? You know, the World Cup, you would think in a lot of sports, is the main prize, but in hockey it still remains the Olympics.
Yeah, I think it does. I think in some ways it's the prestige that we get as an Olympic sport in some ways. You know, you get a group of people who might not support hockey at the World Cup, or they don't understand the Hockey World Cup is as important, you know, as us as players think it is. But the Olympics just allows a group of spectators, a group of supporters, a country to get behind a team that they might not know too much about. So it's a tough one. The Olympics, it probably still is, or it is still the pinnacle for all athletes who can play a part in the Olympics. You know, but I've been so fortunate to play at those last, I've played at 3 World Cups, but being able to win the last 2 World Cups, us as players know how important that is for our sport and this sport in our country. So the Olympics provides that outside influence and brings a massive, you know, or brings a nation together. The Hockey World Cup brings the hockey community together, and that, I think, is the biggest difference.
And there's obviously a lot of rumours that hockey may get turned into a five-a-side tournament at the Olympic Games as they try to appeal to the youth. That's the line we're being fed. But, I mean, what is your view of that? And would you be very sad if that was the case?
Yeah, I would. I find this one really hard to answer, Ash, because I desperately want hockey to remain an Olympic sport. It is a draw card for young kids growing up. So I really want it to become remain an Olympic sport. I'm not a huge fan of hockey fives, if I'm honest. We have so many beautiful fields all around the world, and I just feel like those fields would be a little bit wasted if we start only playing on half of the field with boards or barricades. They have tried it at the Youth Olympics. I don't have a strong enough opinion yet to know whether it's valid or not, or whether my opinion's right. I am a traditionalist. I love hockey as a sport. I love what people say about our game when they're able to watch. But I also know that to remain relevant and really, really significant, we need to be an Olympic sport. So if you said hockey can remain at the Olympics but only in the fives, I would take that, but I'd take 11 aside first.
No, I must admit, I agree with you 100% on that. I'd like to see the Olympics just be all the traditional sports that have been there for 90, 100 years.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Now, I mean, another thing that's happened in your career and has sort of grown is, of course, the video referral and the video umpiring. And as we've seen in all sports, really, it's still not perfect. It has helped avoid some howlers. But again, are you happy that that's come into the game, or do you think it's maybe taken something away from the umpires on the pitch?
No, I'm happy. I think it's one of the things that we need to move. That's another moving with the times part for me is, there's always going to be some variance when you have a video ref who still has to make a decision, and without 100 cameras all in a defensive or an attacking circle, they're not always going to get it right. But I think for the majority of time, hockey are getting it fairly right. As the game grows and improves, I think we need to improve the camera work. We need to get video footage from different areas, because the ball moves so fast, and you've got, you know, there's times where there's 18 or 19 players in a circle, in a small semicircle. So for me, I'm happy with it. I think some of the language barriers that we have with different teams and different umpires around the world, that will continue to remain a focus for growth, you know, umpire development, but also the way teams approach the video referee, knowing that it's not always going to be perfect. But for me, we're just trying to get the right decision more often, and I think the video referral system does that.
Are there any major changes that you would advocate that in the rules that you think we could get rid of that one?
No, not a lot. You know, the overhead rule and players in congestion within 5 meters is far too grey, I think. Danger in sport is also a high priority, so we need to be careful of that one. I don't know what we can do there, but I think that will continue to be talked about forever. You know, things, small modifications. I appreciate that the game, maybe, you know, there might need to be more goals. It might need to be easier for one team. So maybe keeping players outside of the 25 or something like that, where you promote less numbers in that critical areas, will help with video referrals. It might help with more goals. I don't love the 2 points for a goal or 1 point for a corner. But that's early stages. So no, I don't have any strong opinions. But I do think we just need to keep looking for ways, you know, to make it easier for spectators. Could the games be filmed from the ends a little bit more so people can see the leading and don't have to kind of chase the ball side on as much? Is one umpire better with two in the defensive circles or something like that? I don't know. There's things that I think they'll continue to look at. But I've just been playing and I've been so caught up in, you know, performance and my teams and being the best player and leader I could be that I haven't thought too much about the game, you know, externally like I am, and I'm able to now.
Well, you have thought about it a bit because when the Dutch were over, you were saying that you felt Australia really should be looking to take, when international teams come, take them to the country where hockey is obviously very strong and a lot of the talented players that are coming through the Kookaburras and into the Hockey Roos come from the country areas. And I mean, I was pleased to see that your family are actually pushing for the Oceania Cup, I think it is, to be played in Rockhampton.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
That one, Ash, I'm very, very passionate about. I 100% agree that there should be far more games in the regions. If you asked all of the international players who've come to play in Australia how amazing those times are of the hospitality and playing in a different area than they're used to, you know, a different group of people. Yeah, that I'm very passionate about. I think we need to be doing that more. As long as the games are streamed like you have been doing and that continues to get better and better, then we are a sport that are fighting. You know, we're pushing and we're always trying to find ways to be more relevant. Well, this sport is a sport that is relevant in the regional areas, in the country. It's so, so great. And I just feel like we could be feeding that hunger a little bit more.
No, I have to say I agree with you. And I mean, we probably could talk for ages, but I mean, what are you doing now? Because I believe you're working with the Queensland Institute of Sport.
I am, yeah. I'm working at the Queensland Academy of Sport. I'm working in personal development. I'm working with athletes on their journey, trying to make athletes these really well-rounded people. And personal development or personal excellence encompasses so much. It's pretty much everything that's not their competition on the course or in the pool or on the field. So I love it. I work with athletes on well-being, media skills, brand awareness, mental health and well-being, their general journey of the people we want them to become, the people they are, their university, their work life, their family life. And I just absolutely love the space that I work in, Ash. I've put a lot of, you know, effort into being more than a hockey player for a long time, and I feel like I can give some of this experience that I have and the journey that I've been through, I feel like I can feed this down to athletes. And yeah, I work with elite athletes every day now and elite programs and elite coaches, but I don't have to do all the training that they're doing every day. So it's the perfect fit for me, mate.
Sounds perfect. Just before we go, I've got to ask you, do you relive that stroke that you missed in the gold medal game?
No, actually, I haven't really at all. I went to training for the first time about 10 days ago. I had a few weeks off after the comp games, and I went straight to the spot and put the ball down. I thought I just need to go back to the spot and give it one more go. And, I scored, so it was a little bit different. But, no, that was one of those moments where I would have much preferred it to be different, but for everything that happened for me over the past 18 months, you know, since Rio with the team and moving away and the Commonwealth Games over those 15 days with the flag bearer and the way our team just went about it, the attitude, the application, the fun we had as a group, nothing will put a dampener on my Commonwealth Games, not even missing a stroke. So I would have loved it to be better because I do have high expectations and standards of myself, but geez, I'm glad the boys held on for those last 4 or 5 minutes for us.
I'm sure you are. Well, Mark, you've given us some wonderful memories and really do appreciate it. And we hope you enjoy your retirement, and I'm sure we'll see you around sport still for many years to come.
Absolutely will. I will be a part of it. Still love hockey. Just, yeah, looking to do some different things now. But I'll be around hockey anytime. So anyone who's listening, please always come up and say good day.
Well, thanks again, Mark, for your time.
Thanks very much, Ash.
Hi, I'm Willie Miller, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to the podcast of Not the Footy Show. We hope you're enjoying it. Of course, you can get it via our website or on Facebook or, of course, from iTunes, the website being notthefootyshow.com. Well, John, your turn to have a chat about something.
Well, now, you know that I'm not... I try and follow football. I'm not a great fan of the game necessarily, but I like following what they do off the field and the way that they structure their sport and all those sorts of things, and keep my eye on things. We had the, not the final Socceroos squad, is it? It's the second from final.
Yeah, they've announced the 26 and 23 will go to the World Cup.
Australia's leading overseas based goal scorer was left out of that squad. But Tim Cahill was included, a bloke that's played about as much Premier League football in the last few months as I have.
63 minutes, I believe, is all
63?
He's played.
63? Oh, well, that is 63 more than me.
In 5 months.
5 months. Tim Cahill made the team. Now, okay, we've debated that between us on this show before, should he or shouldn't he. I think we've agreed that he probably shouldn't go, but he probably will go. What staggered me was the appearance within minutes of Tim Cahill's being announced in that squad of a fantastic branding opportunity for Caltex. Can you take me through this?
Yeah, look, John, we've talked
off air. What's going on?
We've talked off air about sport and business. And, you know, sport is big business now. And let's not forget that the FFA signed a deal with Caltex. And they are called the Caltex Socceroos now.
Oh.
And so there is obviously a very strong link. Now, I can only imagine, and as I say, we have no proof, that obviously Caltex wanted some guarantees. Now, unfortunately, Tim Cahill is the man they put up for everything. Even though he is 38 years old, you would think there would be a younger player that they would be start pushing as the face of Australian football. But it's Tim Cahill is still who the FFA like to push forward. Now, this TV campaign you talk about came out just after the announcement. Now, you know damn well, as I do, that advertising campaigns such as this or promotions do not happen overnight. They certainly don't happen within 10 minutes of a squad being announced. So this must have been in the planning for at least 3 weeks, 4 weeks, a month, maybe longer. And so you wonder whether Bert van Marwijk was told Tim Cahill will be in your squad of 26. Now, whether he's going to be told he will be in my squad of 23 to go to Russia, that's another question. But I get the feeling that that is going to happen. I think now, just judging by the way this is all played out, I think there is no doubt in my mind that the FFA have told him he has to go to the World Cup.
What happens if Tim suffers a last-minute groin injury? Could that happen, Ashley? Could he mysteriously come down with an ailment just before the 26-man squad's announced?
Of course he could. I mean, who did that? That happened at the last World Cup, wasn't it? There was, I'm just trying to think of who the player was, who was kicking up a bit of a stink, so they agreed to take him, and then before the actual very final deadline of the tournament started, had to withdraw because he wasn't 100% fit, but he still got taken to the World Cup. So you may actually see that, but I think Cahill obviously wants to play in that fourth World Cup.
Desperate
to, yeah, exactly. But I mean, I think it shows that he would have still been training with Millwall, which would have been good. It would have been high intensity training. But as we predicted, he was never, if you look at the way he played in the A-League at the start of this season for Melbourne City, he was never going to get regular game time playing at that level because he's no longer at that level.
And we should respect Tim Cahill in the sense that he doesn't create these situations necessarily. He might be a party to them to a degree. But, you know, Tim Cahill can only do what's asked of Tim Cahill, if you know what I mean. And he's been a brilliant servant of the sport for this country. No doubt is he the right selection at this point in his career and this time in the development of Australian football. That's a completely different question. And, you know, look, fair dogs to him. Caltex comes to him, Football Federation of Australia come to him, oh, we got this brilliant idea, Caltex, tail, you know, whatever. And he goes, yeah, for sure. Am I going? I can't do this if I'm not going.
Yeah, I think you hit on something there, and I look back to the interview we've had on this show with Mark Knowles, and to me, this is just purely my opinion, is I think the true greats in sport know when to quit. And they get out when they're still at the top. I don't think Tim Cahill is at the top now. I think he should have probably quit 2 years ago, in my opinion. However, let's not deny the fact that he was our leading top goal scorer in the qualification for Russia, and he scored the two goals that saw us qualify for Russia. So he showed he could still play a part, and he played a very important part. But to me, his legacy has been damaged slightly by him hanging around when I think the best of him is gone. Now, if we look at Mark Knowles got out, still at the top, still heavily respected. A lot of people thought he was going to go through to the World Cup, but I think...
He should go through the World Cup, but that's not going to happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, but he made that decision, John. So there you go. So you're saying Mark Knowles could have played at the World Cup. There are a lot of people around the world saying exactly that. But rather than, obviously, maybe he felt his body... He knows his body, and I'm sure there were other factors as well in terms of employment and also family... played a part in
sometimes
him making that
cooked.
Decision. Yeah, and sometimes you know that the time is up, that's it. And so to me, if I look at the two of them, and are both are great ambassadors for their respective sports, one got out at the right time, one's hanging around too long.
So Russia's still going to go ahead. We've got past the threat of the games being called up. We've got past the threat of FIFA whatevering they were going to do to the FFA, have we? We'll definitely be there, and it will definitely be happening.
Well, I think now we're definitely going to be there. I think there's still more to play out with FIFA and the FFA, but we'll have to wait and see.
What do you make of the squad?
Interesting. I mean,
disappointed McLaren didn't get in, because he is the form striker of Australian football at the moment. You would have to suggest on figures.
Yeah, I felt very sorry for him, because I think he's done everything that's been asked of him. He's gone overseas, he's had results. And you look at the squad and you go, well, who are you going to leave out now? You know, there are three players that will be omitted. Everybody's very excited, obviously, because there's quite a few A-League players, Josh Brilliante being one of those. You've also got, from the A-League, we've got Josh Risden. Dimitri Petratos is also in there.
Aaron Moy? Oh, no, he's not playing it.
Then we've got James Troisi now.
Danny Vukovic.
Well, he plays in Belgium. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Who's going to be left out? That to me is the big question. We've got, of course, Daniel
Arzani.
Well, they'll take three goalkeepers. They always take three. So there are only three left in the squad, from what I can remember. Matt Ryan, Danny Vukovic, and Brad Jones are the three goalkeepers. So those three are going. My guess at who may well be left behind is, you just wonder with this guy, I don't know much about him, the Fran Karasic, who's not played, he's playing in Croatia.
He's the guy that's never been to Australia before.
Yeah, now he's going to be, I think they may take him because they want to lock him into Australia. So I think he may well go. Will Arzani go, the young boy? He could be very useful off the bench because he's got pace, he's got a little bit of trickery, and also going into a World Cup, people won't know anything about him.
What I don't want to see is people taking development players to a World Cup, because developing players isn't what World Cups are about. World Cup's where you take the cream of the crop, regardless of where they are in their career. If they're good enough, they go. So let's not take a bloke just so that he could go to the World Cup and hope that he's still in form or in good enough form to make it without being called an inverted commas development player.
No, I agree. I think, but if you look at...
Cricket does that all the time, and it's irritating because very often those players just disappear.
If you look at... I was going to say, if you look at Gus Hiddink when he took his squad to Germany, though, he had actually said to people around the team that he was only ever going to use, I think it was 13 players. Now, he ended up using, I think, 14 or 15, but he still apparently had no intention. He knew his core 13 players, and that was what he was going to use. And, of course, that changed slightly because he gave Zeljko Kalak a game when ahead of Schwarzer in the game against Croatia. It nearly cost him dearly. because of people politicking in the background to get Kalach a game, and hitting after that was far from happy. But looking at it, I think Petratos may well miss out. I think Troisi may be another one that misses out. I know he scored the goal that decided the Asia Cup. I'm not sure he's a full-blooded World Cup ability player. Those would be probably the two that I think may be left out. And then it's the million-dollar question. Will it be Tim Cahill? Or, you know, who else would it be left out? We're going to have to probably wait and see.
And while we're on the round ball game, Perth Glory's announced a new coach.
Have indeed. Tony Popovich, which I think is, you know, a very good selection, although I think he's going to be under a bit of pressure, because if you look, he did brilliantly when he started at Western Sydney Wanderers. Then he didn't do quite so well, and they didn't get the results that they wanted. And in fact, as I wrote on the blog, he actually has a worse coaching record in the A-League than Kenny Lowe, the coach that they just sacked. So Kenny Lowe's percentage of wins was actually higher than Popovich's in the A-League. So read into that what you may. I think Popovich is a good coach, but he's going to have to deliver and get results from the word go. Because the one thing the Perth fans do not like is they want their team to be competitive. And they've got on the back of Ian Ferguson. They've got on the back of Ron Smith. They've got on the back of David Mitchell. They've got on the back of Kenny Lowe. They've got on the back of every coach if they don't get the results early in the piece. Now, if the Glory aren't in the top four after seven games, then I think he's going to find the pressure will mount unbelievably, even though he has a three-year deal. It's going to be interesting whether he can attract players over here, because that has been the problem. Nobody wants to come and play for Perth. A lot of that because of the ownership of the club. People know what the owner is like, and they regard it as a basket case of a club on the East Coast. Look, I think he's a good appointment, but he is under pressure. I mean, the results, as I say, weren't going well for him when he left Western Sydney. He then went to Turkey, where it didn't come out the way he would have hoped. So he needs to be successful here. If he's not successful here, he's going to struggle to get other coaching jobs, not just in Australia, but anywhere else. So he has to succeed. Now, in a way, that's good, because that would drive him to really work hard. But he still needs the cattle to be able to succeed. Where I see the problems coming for the Perth Glory is the fact that you have Tony Popovich, who likes to control the footballing side. You've got Tony Pinata coming in as the CEO, who also, from what you hear from people at Sydney FC and Wellington, was very much a man who likes to be in control. And then you have Tony Sage. Now, the three tenors made beautiful music together, but I'm not sure that the three Tonys will. I think there's going to be a real power struggle between those three individuals.
Okay. Just before we go, because I know we have to wrap it up in a minute, well done on the Pacific Rugby Championship stuff you're doing.
World Series Rugby.
World Series Rugby. Congratulations. It's a few red faces in St Leonard's, you'd think, with the success that that's had over the first couple of games. And you know what? Wouldn't it be terrible to be a Queensland rugby supporter at the moment? It would be just absolutely diabolical. And rugby fans across this country must be just spinning heads, trying to figure out what the controlling body has done to that sport in this country.
Well, I'm just going to also give a kudos to Senator Linda Reynolds, because she was the one who forced the Senate inquiry, and she wrote a brilliant piece a week ago saying, you know, how come we had this Senate inquiry where we exposed mismanagement within Australian rugby, and also at board level, and yet all these people are still there, and nobody's actually carrying the can for what's gone on. And it was great to see a politician actually following up on something and going, hang on a sec, we had this inquiry, why has nothing changed? And hopefully something will change, and soon.
I hope none of the people that were involved in all of these dealings and at board level and all that sort of thing run companies that purport to have integrity.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
See ya, we'll be back next week.